The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
LinkedIn presents.
I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and this is The Anxious Achiever, the show that looks at the intersection of mental health and work and how we can all do both better. I love to be able to put new learnings, a new lens or new framework around the everyday situations we find ourselves in at work, the ones that make us anxious or even make us ill. I've been hosting a poll on my LinkedIn page, and I've asked people, you know, have you ever been in a situation with a coworker, a colleague, a boss, a client, or even a project where it's made you so anxious, so worried, you've experienced physical symptoms? And 87% of you have said yes. That's a lot. So I think you're going to find this episode very, very useful. Something I've found very helpful as I navigate working both with leadership above me and trying to think about the best leader I can be to others. Trauma-informed leadership. Our guest today will give us a bit more of a definition, but the way that I think about it is a way of leading that takes into account all the ways that trauma, capital T trauma, lowercase trauma, you define it as you will, might have impacted or still might be impacting those you work with, and acting accordingly. It's a way of thinking about leadership that can make us more empathic and more effective, which is also what this show is about. The method our guest shares today helps anyone build resiliency and skills to stay in the game when things get tough. It gives us resources. My guest is Matthew Cook. He is a partner at Evolution, a coaching, consulting, and investment firm. And Cook shares the way he uses trauma-informed leadership in his own work, how it's changed him and his teams, and offers tangible ways you can start putting this skill set to use and learning more about it. Enjoy. Okay, well, let's get the definitions out of the way. I have two definitions. First is I'd love you to define trauma, and then I'd love you to define trauma-informed leadership.
Yeah, so trauma is something that happens to us that's too much, too quick, too soon. As in too much intensity, too big of an experience, right? Too quickly, like as in I wasn't fully prepared for it. Mm-hmm. As human animals, we have this experience. You see a cat or a dog walk into a new environment, and they immediately do something called orientation, which is exactly what it sounds like. They orient to their environment. So they look around, they take stock of the environment and make sure that it's a safe place to be in. And we unconsciously do this as well as humans. You know, right? Every time you walk into a new coffee shop, you take a look at the surroundings. And that's very much so a healthy thing for us as humans. Now, unfortunately, when it comes to trauma, what becomes difficult is I think a lot of times we think of trauma as something that happened to me. Trauma is actually something that's occurring inside of me right now. So trauma is actually a response that happens in the body from something that, again, at an earlier time, didn't get to complete. And what I mean by that is there's a response, right? So like, you know, that classic, the saber-tooth tiger like pops out, and it's always a saber-tooth tiger, you know, it's always a saber-tooth tiger. So the saber-tooth tiger pops out, and my initial inclination as a human and most animals is out of sheer panic and terror. My very first option is I want to run. I want to get away as quick as possible, and I want to hide. If I'm backed into a corner and that's not an option, and I should extend this just to say that this is everyday occurrences in today's day and age. This could be getting that text message from a loved one. This could be a boss yelling at me. This could be a presentation that doesn't go well. This could be a client asking to end a contract with us. early or something. So my initial inclination is to flight as a human being. Second inclination is, okay, I can't get away. I'm going to fight. And then unfortunately, and what's really difficult and so tough, especially, and this is where trauma-informed leadership comes in, is then the next option is freeze. Mm-hmm. And this is the response in the system where it's like, there's just so much intensity and there's nothing I can do. This is hopeless, helpless. And this is where I just completely shut down and my system just goes, I'm just going to give up. And this is where you see people that sort of just are drifting off and in a daydream most of the time. And I think it doesn't matter really what coast you're on or what part of the world you're in. It's pretty like, I don't know if you'll hear this on the recording, but the kind of like snap your fingers like, hey, are you paying attention?
Yeah.
Are you there? And what's unfortunate is that when someone's body goes into that kind of a response, what's happening is their body is trying to complete the thing that didn't get to happen. What's so interesting is it's sort of a callback for our nervous systems, for our bodies to try to do the thing it didn't get to do the last time. So again, that's where I said at the very top, too much, too soon, too quickly. So it's so strange because it's sort of taking us outside of time and space because our brainstems don't work in linear time. So they're sort of going back and they're trying to make sense and sort of
keep us alive.
Keep us alive. Exactly. Keep us alive. Yeah.
And so trauma-informed, even before we get to leadership, trauma-informed means what?
Yeah, the way I look at it is, so Dan Siegel, if you're familiar, he's a clinical professor of psychiatry, and he coined this term called the window of tolerance or the window of presence, a lot of teachers will also call it. And that sort of best describes sort of the state of, in the trauma world, we call it arousal, but like intensity is another good word for it. Basically, how much can my system handle where I'm still able to function and even ideally thrive in everyday life, right? And so that's why I personally like the window of presence. And I've heard this from a lot of different teachers where it's kind of this Goldilocks effect where it's not too much and it's not too little stimulation, right? And so I think as leaders, especially inside of organizations, it's so important to recognize, and I recognize, especially if we're in the tech world, like it is so tough. We got 2 years, we got very little cash runway. Like we need to do 10 years in 2 years or less. It's very, very difficult, but that is what's being asked of us, especially in today's day and age, is can I be aware of this concept of the window of tolerance, window of presence, and can I really help to support my people to be in that more and more.
So it's keeping people in a state of sort of equilibrium so that their fight, flight, freeze is not constantly summoned, right?
Bingo.
The arousal isn't Bingo. Constant. The cortisol isn't always throbbing.
Yep.
That's interesting because I've also, just in my reading, heard people talk about trauma-informed leadership, and I used to do work in trauma-informed education practice, like also just sort of knowing what this is and how to handle people who may have been in trauma with care so that you're not re-traumatizing as well.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, and I like to think of it, I mean, a lot of times we sort of think the micro fractals out into the macro. And so if I can be aware of this window of tolerance and I can start to this, and I've talked about this on other podcasts as well, is like, I want to start to track. And again, it's like as leaders, we already have so much to be aware of. So I feel like I have so much compassion for leaders because I got to be tracking KPIs. I got to make sure that we're hitting our quarterly numbers. I got to make sure that everyone is, you know, showing up on Slack and doing everything. I also want to start to watch the biology of my people as best as I can. And this starts to fall not necessarily on founders, but maybe on management. I want to start to track my people because, like you said, we certainly don't want to re-traumatize people, but the way the nervous system works is it's sort of waves. It goes in these waves of intensity and de-intensity. So it's a rising and a settling. And that's part of being human and being alive. And so we certainly don't want a flatline, right? But something that we want to start to watch in our people is when is it starting to be too much? And so like you said, if it feels like someone's starting to get too much intensity, in their system, I want to start to see how can I help settle this situation rather than adding more stimulation, right? More stimulus, because more stimulus equals more intensity.
It's exactly what you do when you have a kid
right.
who has a hard time regulating sometimes, is that your first job is to create the container so that they can regulate and not introduce more elements that are going to further the dysregulation.
Bingo. Yep.
Which, you know, in a young kid means they're going to have a total meltdown. So an important thing that I hear you saying is that trauma-informed leadership is not just for people who've been through trauma.
No, it's for everyone. We've all been. Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, it's like I have one of my mentors always jokes. He's like, it's really hard to get out of life without trauma. Like, it's hard to like get to the other end and have not been traumatized at some point. I think, you know, parents mean so well growing up. In general, caretakers really want to give us a good experience. And they're not perfect all the time. It's virtually impossible to be perfect. Kids are going to wind up becoming teenagers and adults who have, experiences of not being met, mm-hmm. of not being met in their needs. And so then we just kind of walk around as these little ones that are in grown-up bodies trying to figure out how to get those needs met. And sometimes that clashes with my work life. It really clashes in my work life.
Sometimes.
Maybe all I mean, the time. It just depends on your job, right?
You would be shocked how much the ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale, comes up on this show when people are talking about their leadership journey because, of course, wherever you go, there you are. And we can bring a trauma with us, even if it's 30 years old, 40 years old.
Yeah, I like to think about that. I'm sure you think of this too, Maura. It's like, I think about it as like most of the time I'm relating to like a little one in an adult body. If you want like a superpower as a leader, obviously speak to people as adults, right? But certainly if I can start to get X-ray vision over time, more and more listening to like, what is the underlying need here that someone is trying to get met? And where can I, as the leader, how can I help to support them in getting that need met?
That's right.
Yeah.
And something I'm doing with my own therapist is a little bit of internal family systems work where it's like, may just be a part of me. Of me may be 47 and professional and go, go, go and hard charging. And then another part of me is still 9. And that's also, I think, important to know.
Yeah. Oh, that's so huge. Thank you for mentioning IFS, because I think you're right. Internal family systems, this idea, and I'm not actually technically certified in IFS. I've done a lot of work around it myself. I've worked with my therapists on it. And the sort of broad premise, as I understand it, is there is essentially, just like you would have family dynamics between you and sister and brother and mom and dad and all the things, there is a whole family of parts inside of us that are constantly at odds with each other at times. And so I think it can be really valuable. And I love you mentioning this, because it starts to take away this sort of black and white binary of like, this person's traumatized and they have a bunch of problems and this person is healthy and they don't. It's like, well, there's actually just like a part of me. There's like a small part of me that needs this one thing. Yeah.
Yes, I was talking to someone, I forget, and they're healed, right? But they're like, I still can't get in an elevator. It's that one piece, you know, and I think that a lot of us have our elevator.
Yeah. Oh, I love that metaphor. Yeah.
Give me an example of how a leader you've worked with, maybe who mm-hmm. considers themselves more trauma-informed, might react to a situation versus, you know, someone who's not aware. So someone who's been working for me for a while, right, they are missing a lot of work. And the rest of the team is complaining about it. They're like, this is a problem. Like, I know that Susie's been here for years, but like, this is stressful. It's not fair on us. We need you to do something.
Yeah, that's a really, really tough one. It also, I'd say so much of this depends on the culture of the company. Mm-hmm. I think what's really interesting, so at Evolution, the firm that I work with, we talk a lot about Ken Wilber's work and spiral dynamics and integral theory. And one of the things he talks about is I, we, it. And then it's, we sort of collapse those down into I, we, it. And just saying that there's obviously the individual that contributes to any situation. There's the collective, the we, and how are we culturally addressing things like this? And then certainly there's the it, which is the systems, the operations, the strategy from a very high level, systemically, how do these things show up? So I think I like to look at it through that lens, is instead of just immediately going to that person and saying, okay, what's wrong with you? Can we as leaders take a step back, and goodness, this is not easy, but to say, are there systems in place that are making this a really difficult job? Like, is it just, I don't remember if you said Susie or what her name was, but you know, whatever her name is, like, is, or him or them, what is preventing them perhaps? Like, is there any responsibility that we can take as an organization? Is there anything that's potentially preventing them and others from showing up consistently? That's certainly number one.
Oh my God, I love that. I've literally never heard the idea of anyone looking at the system first.
Yeah.
How powerful would that be if that happened every day?
It's so powerful. And I think that that's a lot of times difficult to do that. And I think that's why they call us in.
Yeah.
Because it's difficult for us to see ourselves, right? Like, that's not always the easiest thing. However, I find that actually as time goes on, this is the beautiful thing about the evolution of, you know, just industry, is that I think we are becoming more and more self-aware as organizations and seeing these things quicker. The second piece is the we, you know, so if it's not like our values or our mission or anything that's getting in the way necessarily, maybe some of the systems, are there ways that we culturally are encouraging people in certain ways that are maybe actually not advantageous to us producing good quality work and people showing up consistently? For instance, is it the cultural norm that we just start sending Slack messages or team messages at like 2 a.m? Is that just kind of the norm? Because then there's a pretty good likelihood that like people are probably going to get burnt out from that, right? And you can't just tell people, well, just meditate more and just do more yoga and, you know, and then you'll be better and everything will be fine. I'm going to potentially lose my job if I'm not responding to those messages at 2 a.m. or, you know, risk, you know, sort of performance management kind of stuff. So I need to be checking that as well as a leader, is the we. Mm-hmm. Sort of orientation. And then finally, there is the I. And so I don't want to skip over that, because I think the heart of this perhaps is also looking at the I element. Ideally, we're in a culture where we can have these kind of conversations candidly with our people to really understand. Certainly, that's a one-on-one conversation. I mean, hopefully that's clear enough, but that's not a group conversation. That's not like right. Hey, let's just call them out. I think that's a one-on-one conversation. I think it is a really delicate thing of, you know, like I said earlier, what was missing, what needs to happen, what needs to be completed. So if I'm being trauma-informed, I'm number one being aware of what's their window of tolerance. And so I'm starting to understand what's too much for this person, what's not enough. Part of this can also be, am I giving them too much work? Like, can they just simply not handle the amount of work that's being given them? And instead of me judging them or making them wrong for that, then let's just understand that, you know, maybe we do need to put them on a 90-day performance, you know, type of thing. But also, can I just have that really frank conversation with them and say, hey, do we need to find something right now? I want to be a support. I want to really be an ally for what's going on. And I don't know all the details of your personal life or what might be happening, but I want to be an advocate for you here at work. And I want to figure out what is the appropriate amount of work for you at this time in your life. Like, how can we support you in that? And I have actually helped managers have that kind of conversation. And there's so much nuance to it. So it's really hard in a podcast setting to say, well, here's the 3 steps and then everything will be solved, right?
Of course.
But I think that that kind of can start to lead people down that path. Because there are people that just want like lots and lots of work. And like, that's just where they thrive. And they want to work 10, 15 hours a day. And some people, that is, they're in that season of life where that works, and, you know, all the reasons. And just recognizing that not everyone that we initially hired will fall into that category. And they may just have other needs.
I've read a little bit about the idea of accountability in a trauma-informed setting, because I think a lot of leaders, and I hear this from people, well, so-and-so, I know they're having a hard time and they're anxious and they can't come into work in the morning and that's fine, but like, what about me? What about the deliverables? What about the team? Like, how does a good leader weave in accountability while also respecting window of tolerance and the idea that a person might be triggered? They may be living through something that's not integrated and having a hard time.
This is such a good question, Maura. This really, because it is, it's like we are, this is the nuance that we're starting to get to in the workplace. I feel like the generations coming up are so much more, frankly, trauma-informed, but also just like pro-mental health.
Yep.
So these conversations are showing up more and more in the workplace, which is just awesome. And I even saw on your Instagram that you are also pro mental health, obviously, right? Which is just cool.
Obviously. Look, here's the deal though. Yeah. I am very pro mental health. I am pro being open. I even share with people the things that trigger me so that they know if I go a little like off the rails a little bit, it may be because I'm feeling triggered. However, I truly believe that mentally healthy cultures are a two-way street.
Yeah.
I have to do great work. I have to show up. I have to be responsible so that I can get what I need in terms of flexibility and understanding from the people who pay me.
Yeah, bingo. And I think you actually just nailed it, Maura. I mean, that's what I would recommend is the two-way street. I think it's so valuable for organizations. And this can be a conversation that's happening every couple months, perhaps with somebody in a one-on-one, if need be, given their situation, is I want to understand, I want to be really clear in writing, this is what's expected of you. And simultaneously, I would love it in writing for you to really share with me, what are your triggers? What are the things that are really activating or difficult for you so that we can walk this path together and that I can better understand in our relationship as leader and IC or individual contributor or whatever the situation is, but that I can best support you. And actually that goes a really long way for our people in the relationship, in the rapport, in the co-regulation, in the like, hey, I'm in this with you.
What's co-regulation?
Ooh, what's co-regulation? Well, we should start off with regulation. So regulation being the regulation and specifically self-regulation is this idea that I can come back into my window of tolerance. Like I have an ability to settle. We want to talk about anxiety, right? When I start to get too much intensity in my system. So I want you to even imagine like this like little dotted line, and it's this little sort of like a tube. If you have a piece of paper in front of you, you could draw this little tube that's all these dotted lines across. And so ideally, this little wave of our nervous system is going up and down inside of the tube, inside of this little dotted line. Now, if it goes up too high, I can actually bust through that dotted line, that wave can get too high. And that's where anxiety, certainly panic, imposter syndrome, stress, like all of these things that we deal with on a regular basis. So this is not like good or bad. This is not a binary. It's just to say like my ideal is how much more time can I hang out inside of that tube, that window of tolerance, that window of presence, so that I'm ideally more present and able to act in the face of adversity, in the face of intensity, in the face of things that show up in my day-to-day life. So I think you'll see on Instagram and thing, the sort of the Vogue thing right now is like people are putting calm and regulation in the same category. And that's not the case because calm is just one-sided, right? We don't want to just calm down. We also sometimes need some intensity. We need a little bit of, again, like I said earlier, arousal is another term for it.
Good anxiety.
Like we need a little bit of push just to even get out of bed in the morning. Like our system literally releases a little bit of cortisol just to wake us up and get us moving for the day. So I think we sometimes paint these things as like, this is bad. And that's not the case. We need a little bit of the up and we need a little bit of the down. And the issue is when we get an imbalance where we have too much down or too much up. And so regulation, again, is my ability to over time have more and more time spent inside of that window of tolerance. And so when I have co-regulation, this is what's really beautiful, is the ability as a team member, or if we're getting more personal, as a friend, as a spouse, right? As just anyone in our life can be there to help support us to come back into that window of tolerance. And again, that's regulation and co-regulation. The other fun thing is you can even do little furry friends. You know, if anyone has pets, pets are amazing co-regulators. Let's talk about practical resources. This is in somatic experiencing and organic intelligence and all the different trainings that I've had over the years. This is like one of the key things that they teach us is that I'm going to get activated. Mm-hmm. It's a part of life. I think this is the issue is we sometimes fall into this category of like, I just need to be perfect all the time. I like to give this metaphor of being on a surfboard. It's like, I need to always be on my surfboard. I always need to be surfing the wave. And in fact, I need to delude myself and others to believe that I'm always on the surfboard. When it's actually better for me, instead of being perfect, it's actually maybe more about my time of getting back on the surfboard. So like, it's actually how quickly can I get back on the surfboard? It's not if I fall off the surfboard, it's when I fall off the surfboard. How quickly can I get back on the surfboard? So just to use a metaphor to tag along with that window of tolerance, how quickly can I get back into the window of tolerance? And one of the ways that we do that is resources. And again, it's so funny because this will probably be less learning for people and feel more like remembering because these are things that we all unconsciously do all the time. So when I am stressed and I'm a little baby, I'm like 2-3 years old, I have my blankie. Mm-hmm. Right? I have my blankie. And as an adult, I might have a water bottle and I may not even realize it, but I like when I'm stressed, I go to my water bottle to drink water. And I, you know, I put a, like my little electrolyte packets in it or whatever it, you know, but like, or maybe you really enjoy being in your bedroom, laying in your bed and closing the doors, or maybe it's being in your car and having that sort of containment, that level of safety of just being in your car all by yourself. I mean, there's a million examples. And so what
there's a million,
right? I encourage people, you know, another one is plants. My goodness, the green of seeing plants and being in nature and taking walks, like, oh, what a good resource. So it sounds so rudimentary, Maura, but the interesting thing is the brainstem is very rudimentary. So like the brainstem, the amygdala, right? I'm sure your people know that stuff. Those aspects of our brain need these very rudimentary ways of coming back into, again, regulation or our window of presence, window of tolerance, into sort of a sense of safety.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
I want to talk a little bit about a team that's been through trauma, which unfortunately is many teams, whether it's literally a shared trauma on the workforce or a collective trauma. And I'll use a personal example that I've really been struggling with, which is that one of my consulting clients that I work very, I was embedded with them. So not staff, but working like staff at the time. We lost our boss very suddenly overnight. Just very unexpectedly. And we loved her and we valued her. And one of the most powerful things that one of her team said to me when dealing with the grief a few weeks later is, you know, I lost who she was in my life and the person that I loved. And I lost the promise and the hope and the vision that she offered us. And I don't know how to reconcile my workday now without that. I mean, that hit me like a ton of bricks, right? Yeah. Because as part of the team who was trying to both keep the train running while allow for grief,
right?
I didn't have any good answers.
Of course, right? That's
I mean, we tried to learn and we tried to bring in people who knew. We tried to give each other grace and space and understand that people grieve in their own way, but it's really hard because work doesn't stop.
Right, right. Work doesn't stop. Yeah. Yeah, I think we need to recognize that these are work traumas, but they're also very personal. I mean, like this person, my goodness, like it just really hit them like a ton of bricks. And then you had the sort of cascade effect of that, of experiencing it personally, but then also having to, you know, working with her and experiencing her loss as well. I mean, it's interesting. So I talked about at the very beginning too, is like trauma is something that happens too much, too soon, too quickly. Hmm. And it really mm-hmm. sounds like that's what happened. This just happens so quickly, too soon. And so I think the question that I always want to ask is, and again, this is very much so like leaning into Peter Levine's work and somatic experiencing. I mean, what we're always asking is, what was missing? What didn't get to happen? And how can I sort of like resource that thing that didn't get to happen? So out of curiosity do you have a sense on that, Maura?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to talk out of turn because I work with this team very closely, but that was resource, the vision that our CMO, Beenish, brought us, literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you talk about somatic, why is that so important in trauma? What does that mean? Why is it so important?
Oh, goodness. Somatic. I mean, well, somatics is a term that was coined in the 70s by a gentleman named Thomas Hanna, but it's this idea that the living, breathing, alive body mind. It's this idea that like the body and the mind are inseparable. And obviously, you know, like Rene Descartes.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I think, yeah, all the things. And it's this duality of these two things are split. But I mean, certainly anxiety and all of these things that we experience, with, especially with big moments like this, it's like they live in the body. They hang out in the body. And then my mind makes meaning of that and goes like, oh, I'm experiencing grief. I'm experiencing XYZ, but it's something that certainly lives in the body. And so I think a lot of times, unfortunately, we try to bypass the body and just like ignore that thing. But the issue is, this is where we talk about like repression and where like trauma like will just suddenly come rear its ugly head, sometimes years and decades later, because we ignored that felt sense of what, again, what didn't get to happen. Like my body didn't get to complete some kind of response that it was asking to do, whether it was to run, whether it was to fight. And maybe there's no person that I'm going to go claw their eyes out, but there is like this feeling that like my body needed, there was an impulse, there was a behavior that needed to happen. And unfortunately didn't get to happen. Sometimes we even use the image channel, like what are some of the ways that I could sort of resolve that experience? Now, I should also like totally preface with all this, please go see a therapist, a mental health practitioner for these types of things. If you somatic experiencing, phenomenal program and phenomenal practitioners that come out of that training. That's really what it is helping. And a lot of times it's really difficult to do this stuff on our own because it's really hard to see directly into what's happening in my body. But a trained practitioner can really help us resolve those things. Sometimes it's even in gesture. So as I talk about this person, you know, I'll give a sweet example. Is sometimes I talk about this person and there's my hand just sort of automatically, unconsciously, you know, especially if you like are Italian or something. Italians really know gestures, right? But it's my body speaking. It's the language of the body is gesture. And so sometimes my hand, as I talk about this person, maybe my hand will just rub my chest really gently. And that is a really, it's an unconscious and it's beautiful. It's my body actually self-soothing. Hmm. It's my body's attempt to come back into my window of tolerance, my window of presence to soothe me. And so it sounds like these folks, you know, in your situation, like really are needing a lot of tender soothing, certainly, but a lot of resourcing of like, what's the thing that really needs to happen in order for closure to happen. Mm-hmm. This is like the really important word is closure. I need to feel a sense of completion. What's really difficult, unfortunately, is a lot of people that are stuck in, Peter Levine calls it the trauma vortex, is I don't actually feel a sense of completion. And so it feels to my body like the thing is still happening.
And can be summoned quickly.
Yes. Yes. The moment that there's that person that shows up that doesn't have the promise and the hope and the vision, suddenly I spiral out because I don't have those resources. Like those were resources that were there, that were available, that I knew I could rely on predictably, consistently. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt those things were there. And then suddenly the rug got pulled out from underneath me. And like, my goodness, I have so much compassion. In this moment, my heart just like really goes out to this person and this team because it's real. It's really, really real. I mean, and yeah, I don't want to like just dump more on this, but you know, I think about just so many teams when 2020 hit, like literally across the entire world, we have this collective experience of so suddenly our lives being turned upside down. And so I think for so many of us, we're just crying out for what is completion? Like, what do I need to complete this and come back into safety, into a feeling of like, okay, like that thing is done.
Can teams, like at the team level, create that safety zone for a colleague who needs it?
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, that's the beauty of offsites, right? And the beauty of, you know, getting to be together in person. I think that there is some work that can happen over Zoom and over, you know, Riverside and other apps, but you really can't replace being with other people and grieving in community. We only in the last, you know, couple hundred years really separated ourselves out, but I'm sure so many people have mentioned this, but we are so tribal as humans. Mm-hmm. Like we desire, if you want to think of like a wolf pack, you know, like there is something so important about community and about being together and experiencing together. One of my teachers, Steve Hoskinson, he actually talks a lot about like, if you notice even sports teams, they will like line up at the end line together and then they'll start doing their stretches and their warmups in unison. So yep. There's something about us that like syncs up. That it's again co-regulation, right? It's we sync up together, and it's
love
beautiful.
That. Yeah, it really is. Mm-hmm. Zooming out a little bit,
yeah.
What's the business case here for people who are mm-hmm. listening to this? And this is like this is a bunch of feelings, and you know, like the job market's terrible, so I don't care. Like, what's the business case for this work?
You know what? This is great. I'm going to actually like, I want to totally just like soothe all the doubters on all this and just say like, listen, if like strictly the mind is working for you, then like keep at it. Like truly. And that's not even to be tongue in cheek. I mean, I'm a little tongue in cheek, but it's like, but truly if it's working, then my goodness, keep up with it, because we live in a society that rewards the meaning-making channel, the thought channel. If it's not helpful, cut it out. So to me, it's like if the thinking only route is working, then great. However, I will say that a lot of my people now are sort of waking up to this idea that my body might actually have some data for me. And especially those of us who are data driven, and most of our organizations are very data driven, that as individuals, if I'm tracking the data that my body and mind are giving to me, then that can actually start to inform positive outcomes for the team, for certainly myself as a performer on the team. But I think that that's like, it's a very bottom-up approach. But I think the idea that if I'm performing better, then my team's performing better, then the whole organization is performing better. And then if we're taking accountability as leaders to encourage our people to track this data more and more. So Body-Based Breakthrough, B3, is our training program. And so we actually work with a lot of coaches and therapists and healers and facilitators and people that are wanting to support their clients in this way. But one of the things that we talk about a lot of times is it's actually really important that I start to understand emotions are not completely to be dismissed, that sensations in my body are not to be completely dismissed. So for instance, when I think about that report that's due, certainly having a little bit of buzzing in my chest might not be a bad thing. But if I know that we have unsavory business practices and we're like fudging our numbers and we're doing some things that just really feel out of integrity for me as an individual, and I keep having this heavy, heavy feeling in my gut every single day for weeks and weeks and months on end, that is data. That's really important that it's like, it's not just affecting my mind, it's also affecting my body. And so again, I like to steer completely clear of the woo-woo and just say like, it's just more data. It's just more information for me. If I walk up to my manager and every time that I see them, you know, there's this flash of,
yes,
you know, in my mind of this like scary 10-headed monster. It's like, well, that's also data. Again, I don't have to follow all of that data. Just like at an organization, we might go, yeah, let's actually just ignore that information. It's not as helpful for where we're trying to go. But if I'm tracking the different sort of channels of experience that I'm having as an individual, now again, having a coach, having somebody to support you and doing this is really helpful, a therapist, but it's certainly really important for me to look at all the different nuances. For me, that's the business case, is just as I would look at all the numbers, I want to look at all the channels of experience that I have just simply being a human being.
Yeah, no, I always say if I had a nickel for everyone who describes how they feel nauseous before their weekly one-on-one
yes.
with their boss.
Yep.
I want to ask you another question because I know you work with a lot of tech leaders, and I just gave an interview to a business publication about this. You know, there was a lawsuit, a pretty senior guy at Goldman Sachs sued Goldman for their toxic work culture. And there's a theory that some very hard-driving, high-performance, pretty cutthroat organizations like prey on people's insecure need to achieve. And my theory is also really keep us dysregulated. We've all had that boss who yeah. keeps us on a knife edge as a way of trying to motivate us,
yeah.
which seems to me the opposite of trauma-informed and keeping people
absolutely.
In the window.
Yep.
And that is something that has renewed attention, certainly in Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad more and more that that's being looked at.
Well, but I also think it's being looked at in a way of like, yeah, you know what? This isn't the job market of 2 years ago. You better
right.
get your act together, and you better be anxious about your job, because if I okay. fire you, there's going to be 2,000 new applicants. So I feel like those of us who are trying to preach this stuff are a little bit swimming upstream in some industries who are like, no, yeah. I want my people dysregulated and hungry.
Yeah, you're totally right, Maura. I mean, this is where it comes down to personal choice, right? And like boundaries, right? Because I think you're spot on to say, just like we said with like, is the thinking like working for you? And if like you don't want to pay attention to such stuff, if it's working for you, keep going at it. So I think part of this, and again, this is, I don't want to do a blame the victim, right? We got to be really careful of that, is as best as we can recognizing what is my boundary here. Actually, I work with a lot of senior leaders at some companies that I will not name because there are some very toxic leadership practices happening right now. And you're right, especially because it's like, it's just like you said, it's not the way it was. There's lots and lots of cuts. I think you just have to recognize like, what's my absolute no? Like, what is no, I will not go there. It's really confronting for me to recognize, I think our job is supposed to be a place that like looks after us, you know, like they want the best for me.
Says who?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's the thing that we need to really update in our lexicon, is that like, that was in the 60s, 70s, 50s, whatever, like where, you know, you had your pension and all the things, where it's like the company looked after you. And it's just, that's not what the job market is. And that's not the way that the world works anymore. And so I think we need to sort of hit the refresh button and recognize I need to, goodness, I hate saying this. It's like, I need to look after myself. I really hate to say that because I want to believe in a Pollyannish world, but it's just not what we're in at all. And so I need to recognize what are my limits, and that I can't necessarily trust that the company, or even perhaps even like you said, maybe even the boss doesn't necessarily have my best interests in mind. They're actually in the best interests of what are our quarterly numbers. And you're either a cog in this machine or you're not. I'm really realizing that sounds so horribly bleak, but I don't know, Maura. Like, would you agree?
It's freeing.
Like, I don't,
well, it can be very freeing, right? It can be very freeing to be like, I need to protect myself and this isn't my everything. I when you were talking, what sprung into mind was, you know, say that I am someone who has a history of abuse, or trust is hard for me. I've been through significant trauma. And I enter into a place where that trust is taken away from me. I have a good couple of years, and now, say, 2023, I get laid off. No warning. Remember, to your point, quick, unexpected. Knowing that this is the world that I am going to be working in, how does someone who has been through trauma protect themselves to come into the modern work environment, knowing that we have no guarantees?
Yeah. Resource. Yeah. You know, I was talking about the window of tolerance, and it's like, well, in a Pollyannish world, like, we're hanging out just like our wave is going inside of, like we said earlier, that sort of tube, that dotted line too. And it's just kind of hanging out inside of there, and we're present all the time. But, you know, this isn't Anne of Green Gables, you know, like, we don't like live in like the back country. It's like, no, we live in a world where we are constantly outside of our window of tolerance. So it's actually an imperative, and especially even more so if you are in the tech world, to know your resources. I really mean that. Again, it's like, I don't want to sound too like simple with all this, but you need to know what are the things that resource you and what are the things that drain you, and recognize, is there an alignment here? Is there an alignment between the way that my job is going? In fact, I liked it a lot of times with my clients, I'll do an agreements exercise. Like, what are the things that I'm agreeing to in all areas, like across all dimensions of my life? So this, if you want to talk about practical, sit down and write out a list of, in my relationship with my spouse or my kids or my friends, whatever, what in my career, what am I agreeing to? In my health journey, what am I agreeing to, right? Like, you could even go spiritual, emotional, whatever. Like, you could go down the list of all the different dimensions, perhaps, of life. What am I actually consciously or unconsciously agreeing to right now? And that, I think, is like a big eye opener for a lot of people. And then whatever I'm agreeing to, what is resourcing me? Again, yeah. What's giving me life, right? Like, what's like helping my life force move forward in a positive direction for me? And then what's really draining my energy? And that can be so powerful, because I, as one human, have to exist across all these different dimensions, and I only have so much bandwidth. And I think we forget that. It's like, wait, no, I have to be all things to all people. And that's just not true if you want to be sane, right? Like, if you want to, it's a recipe for anxiety and disaster and chaos if you try to be all things to all people. I guess I'm realizing I'm saying that a little bit like off the cuff, almost a little jokingly, but I'm realizing for some people that actually might be a really big eye opener. Like, maybe you are trying to be all things to all people. And I guess I just want to encourage you again to do that exercise and to just recognize, where do I need to look at where I have the capacity to actually touch all of these areas of my life? And here's the thing, really quick, if I can, with this exercise, we don't actually always realize this. There are three different things that I can do with an agreement. This is going to sound so silly. I can keep the agreement, certainly, right? Anything that I'm agreeing to do. I can obviously break the agreement, which, that sucks. That's no good to anybody. I can just continuously like not show up to the gym when I tell my friend I'll be there at 6 a.m. That's not going to go well for my relationship. It's not going to go well for my health. And the third option, though, and this is the one that we don't actually always think about, is like, Maura, I can renegotiate an agreement.
That's right. I can choose. Yeah.
I can choose. Like, I can literally go to this person and say, hey, listen, I'm so sorry. I'm really realizing 2 years ago when I agreed to go to the gym with you at 6 a.m., I'm recognizing that worked at that time. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'm just coming to a season in my life where it's just like, it's actually not possible right now. I'm realizing, because of, you know, I have a new kid, I have a new puppy, I have XYZ, my work is, I'm realizing like, I need to renegotiate this agreement. I'd still love to go to the gym with you. Can we go at 7? Like, would you be open to that? Again, this is a silly example, but I hope we're all sort of extrapolating that out across our lives, is what agreements do I need to renegotiate? Or end.
Yeah.
I guess that's the fourth option. What agreements do I just need to like completely cut off? It's like, okay, this is just not working anymore. And again, this can go into our work life. So maybe I've taken on so many responsibilities because, again, like you said, I'm trying to like spin all these plates because your boss is threatening that there's 2,000 applicants right behind you, really excited to take up your spot. This is, again, where I need to recognize, what is my capacity as a human for fear of burning out, perhaps, right? Because again, once I burn out, then I'm no good to anybody, including myself, right? So what's my capacity? And starting to bring that up more and more with my boss is like, hey, listen, I want to perform at a really high level. My father has spent his entire career in human resources. So he always talked about this concept of WIFM, what's in it for me.
Yeah. I use that as a marketer.
Yeah, what's in it for me, right? And so it's like, I want to actually like present this in a way to my manager is like, what's in it for them? You know, like, so listen, I want to perform at a really high level at this organization. And I'm realizing that I actually took on so many responsibilities because I care so much, because I want to perform at a really high level. I'm not giving you the best of what I have. And so I'd love, you know, insert solution, right? Rather than just like, I have a problem, help me, right? Which again, that's fine. And that happens sometimes. But ideally, managers, leaders really love it when we come in with a solution. So not only do I have a problem, but also here's a potential solution.
That's it for today. Our show is produced and edited by Mary Du. Our assistant producer and sound engineer is Nick Krinko. Many thanks to the LinkedIn Presents family and to all our guests for sharing their stories. If you love the show, tell your friends. I would love you to leave a review because they really matter in helping the show get found. You could also follow us or subscribe. If you have a question for me or you want to submit an idea for the show, find me on LinkedIn, where you can follow me, message me, I promise I'll write back, or subscribe to my newsletter for more from the anxious achiever world. Thanks for listening.